BOAG World is produced by the web design agency headscape.co.uk.
Hire them now!
This week on BOAG World, the tables are turned as Paul and Marcus get interviewed. We talk about IE9 and hear a great perspective on accessibility.
Podcast for all those involved in designing, developing, and running websites on a daily basis. Hello and welcome to the 205th episode of BOAGworld.com, the podcast for all those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. This week's episode is called IE9 Cometh. My name's Paul BOAG.
My name's Marcus Lillington.
Lillington. Comes to something where you can't say your own name, Marcus.
You have to stop. You have to pause before you say Lillington.
Oh, okay.
And then it comes out okay.
But if you go, it
doesn't work.
So, yes, we were having a great conversation just before the show started. We were discussing if one of us died, whether the other one would carry on with the show. And the conclusion was both of us could if we wanted to, but neither of us could be bothered.
Certainly I wouldn't. Let's put it that way.
No. And we were also discussing whether we were becoming parodies of ourselves, which made me giggle, but it probably doesn't sound very funny repeating it back.
No, but probably very true. There'll be people nodding all around the world.
There we go. So it's now nice to be back from South By, back to sunny England.
It wasn't too bad.
No,
well,
it
actually, wasn't Saturday terrible. Was appalling, but yeah. Yesterday was quite nice.
Yes. Oh, we're so British.
Talking about
Let's discuss the weather.
Yes.
Had a good time at South By, met loads of cool people.
Yes.
Loads of people. They kept flocking around me, Marcus, throwing themselves at me.
Did they?
No. But they might have. In my head, they did. When I did the book signing, people came out. Actually, it was really funny. So this is really boastful. This kind of sums up my inflated ego, but it did amuse me.
Right. So I know what you're going to say.
So I arrived at my book signing.
Can I whistle?
No. I arrived at my book signing, which, by the way, had been rescheduled. My book signing. For my best-selling book. I don't know what counts as best-selling. Could be best-selling. Best-selling book in Dorset. And as only three people can read, that's quite an achievement. So I was doing
Didn't Hardy come from Dorset?
Oh, good point. So damn, not the best-selling. So I was sitting there, I arrived for my book selling, as you do. And there was another author there. And and I said to him, have you ever done one of these before? It's a bit weird, isn't it? It's a weird thing to do. He said, yeah, I've done several of them. He said, don't get your hopes up. You sit here for ages and then nobody turns up and then you feel really demoralized and you leave. At which point about four people immediately walked up to me and I had a line of people most of the time and he went away in a huff. So that's how cool and important I am.
When I was in the music business.
I don't care about that.
We used to do just called signings, which was basically usually...
Breasts.
Well, it quite often was, yes.
See, nobody asked me to do that.
But it was usually record sleeves.
I don't think any of them were female.
We gave up after 8 hours solid queuing once. We said, that's not doing it anymore. And that was in Seattle.
You show off.
Ha, 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 ha.
I was very pleased with my hour.
But you were being boastful and I had to drag you down a peg.
Yeah, I did deserve it. I was a bit full of myself, wasn't I? No, I had a really good time. I met some really cool people. And yeah, it was good, wasn't it?
I think the quality of the speaking was the best I've ever seen there in my
4 years. See, now, not for me.
Well, it was for me, so there. Ha. Everyone kept saying, I'm going to start following Marcus.
Yeah, you've got really good speaking people this time.
I was quite, you know, selective. I didn't go to everything on every day. Far from it, in fact. I probably saw, I don't know, a dozen talks, and apart from one, I sat through all of them and was deeply enthralled.
Was that my one you walked out of?
No, I went to one which I thought sounded interesting, but it wasn't at all. Yeah, you were actually quite good, Paul.
Oh, thank you.
Not bad.
Not bad.
Yeah.
So the reason I enjoyed this year is because I met loads of people that I didn't previously know, because there weren't many of the English lot there.
No.
So I met lots of new people, and I met some really cool guys and girls, he has to say, quickly.
Just to go back, I was so inspired by two of the talks I went to that I bought their books.
Wow, for you.
And
that's incredible.
Unheard of.
You won't actually read them, obviously.
I've already started Christina Halvorsen's.
What's her book about?
Content strategy.
Ooh.
Which sounds really dull, but she made it seem really interesting.
Does her book make it seem interesting?
Yeah.
So it's worth getting, is it?
Yes.
The book that I got off the back of it was Rework, Jason Fried book.
Yes.
The new 37 Signals book. That's good.
Because I remember Relly was on talking about books on the 200th show. I think
yeah.
It was the 200th show. It was one of hers, actually. No, I hadn't put two and two together, but I tweeted about wanting to buy this book, and she said, yes, that's the one at the top of my pile. I hit people with it.
Always a good use for a book.
To bang the knowledge into them.
Yes, because it works, that, hitting
Absolutely.
People repeatedly
yes.
around the head. Anyway, should we move on to the news? So the Web Design News is brought to you by a Web Designer Depot. The Web Designer Depot is a popular web design blog covering tutorials, design trends, blogging and inspirational posts. They keep sending me nice little emails encouraging me. We really like your stuff, Paul.
Keep sending me presents. That would be even better, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, now I'm really disappointed with the emails. I would be. I was really pleased with them before you said that. Now, oh well, screw you. Screw you then. If you care about them, and I wouldn't really, but if you do care about the Web Designer Depot, you can find out more about them at webdesignerdepot.com. And you can also follow them on Twitter at Designer Depot and maybe send them notes saying send Paul presents. So there you go.
They really appreciate that, I'm sure.
It's nice of them to send me little notes.
Yes.
They're nice people. Anyway.
Good.
So our first news story, the big news of the week, is Microsoft is giving us a glimpse of IE9 at the Mix conference, which was happening while we were in South By. Should we drop that in a few more times, how we were in South By? And this has been followed up since then with some more details on the IE blog and the release of the IE9 platform preview, which I think is basically an alpha version of IE9. But it's cool. The focus of the news browser, so IE9, I can't believe they're following up quite quick. It's good. They're beginning to kind of, you know, compete with the other browser manufacturers in terms of bringing out stuff regularly.
The big thing will be is when will IE10 appear? Because if IE9 is doing all the things, it appears to be ticking all the boxes.
Yeah.
So then they'll think in a kind of
flying
potentially
monkeys.
Kind of Microsofty kind of way. They might be different now, but in the way they used to be. You see how much I'm skirting around this?
You are. You're being very diplomatic.
They might think, well, that's good enough. Done.
Do you reckon?
Don't know.
Because the web always moves on.
Well.
There's always new stuff.
Well, yes, of course. But they tend to be reactive, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think there was some narrow-sightedness in Microsoft for quite a long time, which I do think has gone away a little bit. For a while, they were, you know, saying they weren't going to produce any more versions of IE. They'd given up.
Yeah.
So, anyway, the new browser focuses on things like performance, standard support, and improved font rendering, which is all good news for us web designers. The response has been generally positive from what I've read in the web design community.
Mm-hmm.
And Zeldman writes, the reported web standards improvements are encouraging, and better type rendering in IE is a
consummation, much to be desired.
Thank you.
I finish all your sentences. Pick any word. I mean, it means I have to really concentrate.
I actually read things.
Yeah.
Who commented next then?
Oh, no, I can't start them.
Oh, Roger Johansson was equally enthusiastic when he wrote,
I'm still amazed at how few IE8 problems related to CSS 2.1 I've run into. If IE9 can deliver that level of support for HTML... Pardon of that. Oh, stop it.
HTML5, DOM, and CSS3, and...
SVG, yay. This isn't working. Carry on.
No, it isn't, is it? So, so basically, the responses from the web design community have been pretty good.
It seems to be supporting everything it's supposed to.
It does, doesn't it? It seems to be getting there anyway. Unsurprisingly, the announcement has further flamed the war against IE6. However, over at SitePoint, there's an interesting article that points out that we're never going to be happy with the user's choice of browsers. And they write, so will the end of I6 make you, me, and everyone else happy? 10 years ago, we were calling for Netscape 4 to die. Oh, I remember that. If you thought IE6 was bad, Netscape 4 would have appalled you. IE6 death may be imminent, but will we start... What is wrong with us today?
Well, it's called a very slight amount of jet lag. Demonizing. There we go.
It's a simple word.
Yes, but anyway, I've said it now. You can move on.
No, I'm going to say it. Demonizing.
There we go.
Other browsers.
It is different, though. It's not the same as Netscape 4, because Netscape 4 died in about 2 or 3 years. I6 has taken at least 5.
That is true. That is true.
But this isn't... IE9 coming out has got nothing to do with IE6 going away.
No.
Nothing. Well, that's not... Nothing at all doesn't... That's
it
not
puts increased pressure on corporate.
Yeah, on the corporates who are still sticking to IE6 because they don't want to redesign the application that they had built 5 years ago or whatever that only runs on IE6. That's still going to be there.
Yeah.
However, yeah, I suppose another new version of IE might make them feel slightly pressurised.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I agree with this statement that, you know, once I6 goes away, people are just going to be annoyed about IE7 because IE7 is not as good as IE8 or Safari or Firefox or anything else. It goes on and on.
I'm showing my ignorance there. Is there not a huge gulf between IE6 and IE7 compared to the gulf between IE7 and IE8?
Yes, there is a bigger gulf, but there is still stuff that's not right with IE7. Hmm. So, yeah. I agree with the site point article. I think we're never going to be happy. There's just no pleasing some people.
Never going to be happy. Never going to be happy.
Okay, next news story.
I'm always happy. All the time.
That is so not true. You are turning into a grumpy old man, actually.
What have you been turning into?
We've been discussing this behind your back, and we generally feel that you're going through some kind of midlife crisis.
No, not at all.
Is that not true?
No.
You haven't got a desire to buy a posh car?
Oh, always.
Yeah, my point has been proved.
No, but I've had that always.
Okay.
So how's that a crisis of midlife?
It's just a very long midlife crisis that started when you were a teenager.
When I was 20, yeah.
Anyway, next story. There's an interesting new web design blog on the block this week.
Blog on the block?
Blog on the block.
Okay.
So you might be asking, why do we need another web design blog? And this is a perfectly valid question. In fact, there was a post not long ago about why do people stop starting web design blogs and actually just write for the ones that are out there. But this one, called RailPost, is different. As the site says, RailPost digs deep to bring you fresh content from the hottest web designers and the coolest blogs serving you juicy related goodness. In other words, they don't write anything themselves. They just hand-pick the best web design posts that are about there and kind of collate them together into one handy place. So it's useful if you have trouble keeping on top of your RSS feeds, because this is one place you can go just to get loads of inspiration. So I wanted to give it a quick mention.
Okay.
Talking about random resources that are worth a mention, I wanted to mention that Mark Bolton's book, Designing for the Web, which has been out for a while and is an excellent introduction into good design. The reason I'm mentioning it now is because he's re-released it for free, which is an absolute bargain. It must be very irritating to all the people that spent money on it. No, I'm sure not.
Well, yes, actually.
Well, it was quite a while ago, and to be honest, it wasn't very expensive, and
okay. He's
a cool guy, and you like to support him. So
fair
enough. I think it's good. So if you're a designer, developer, or content producer, then reading this book will enrich your website and plug holes in your design knowledge. So I highly recommend it to pretty much anybody, really. Very good one. And now it's free. It's even better. That is interesting, mind. Do you devalue your work by releasing it for free?
Well, not if you...
Says the man that's been releasing a podcast for how long?
Yeah, but you've never charged for it. Is my point.
Ah.
You can compare it to, like, I don't know, gyms, for example.
So what you're saying is that Baragwood has always been worthless, while Mark Bolton's work had worth, and he's now given that worth away.
No. What immediately came to mind are things like sports clubs, gyms,
yeah.
Who you buy a yearly membership, and you always have to pay your kind of upfront joining fee.
Yeah.
Fee, which in times of plenty will cost you thousands. It's £2,000 to join.
Right.
Whereas when like it is at the moment, times are hard, they'll kind of waive the joining fee.
Right.
And it's like how to irritate all the people that have spent 2,000 quid when times were good.
Yes.
It really winds people up. Mm. So don't do it.
Okay. So Mark, you're wrong. Take away those free copies.
It's slightly different.
You're a grumpy old man, aren't you? See, it just proves it, man, because he's giving something away for free to encourage the quality of design on the web, and you're saying that should be snatched out of the hands of
I don't know what I'm saying. I'm just saying any words at the moment. Designs.
Okay. While on the subject of design...
I disagree with myself, actually.
Do you?
Probably tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
And then go back to the other way.
Yeah, okay. Do you know, we were supposed to be keeping the main segments more slick, weren't we? So that it worked better in the bite size and the people that didn't like the waffle could avoid it. We're not doing very well, are we?
Well, I think you need to try harder then, Paul.
Oh, it's my fault, is it?
Yeah.
While on the subject of web design principles, he says, moving on quickly, can I suggest you check out two posts on the 52 Weeks of UI blog? These posts tackle both visual hierarchy and visual weight. They're excellent reading for anyone interested in understanding better how design works. And the posts not only explain what visual hierarchy and weighting is, they also explain why it's important. For example, when talking about hierarchy, the author writes, the best visual hierarchies lead users to take the action confidently. They have a clear, obvious order in which to view and act on things with the most important things first. These are actually great posts for non-designers because it explains the things that designers often do intuitively but rarely can explain very well. You know, designers can be terrible at kind of explaining basic design concepts to other third parties, so this should really help with that. So check it out. Our final news story today is about bringing psychology to web design. And if possible, if it was possible to have a single theme for the South by Southwest conference, which is difficult because it's such a diverse conference, I'd say this year the theme was about psychology. So you had from Andy Budd's talk on persuasive design to Stephen Anderson, who looked at the art and science of seductive interaction. It seemed to be all about motivating and inspiring users to do what you wanted. One thing that grabbed my attention the most in Stephen Anderson's talk was something called mental note cards that I wanted you to check out. Although not currently available, though they are going to be available very soon, he did give out some preview cards to all the attendees, and I have to say they're truly awesome, as those Americans would say.
Awesome.
Awesome. Each one of the 50 cards that come in this pack of cards has some characteristic of human psychology. So if it then, in effect, is suggesting ways that you can use those characteristics to improve your website. So what you do is you lay out the cards face down, you take one out, and you read the card, and then that hopefully will inspire you to do something to your website. So just to give you an example, one card is about curiosity. When teased with small bits of interesting information, people will want to know more. And so that, and you can think about your site and think, okay, well, how can I do that kind of thing? How can I tease people and make them curious to explore further? And I think this is a great little tip for helping you shape the design of your site. And they're a really useful set of cards to have. And there's a real, was a real feeling at South By, at least from my perspective, that subjects like usability, accessibility and standards were being pretty much taken for granted. They were kind of presuming that people were taking those things seriously. And so instead, the conference seemed to focus on the nuances that take your website to the next level. And I think things like these mental cards are a great way of doing that. So check them out. There's a link in the show notes at boagworld.com/podcast/205. I think that wraps up the news. So when we were at Future Web Design, we met up with Keir Whitaker and Mike Coos from Carsonified, and they were very naughty, weren't they? They turned the tables on us.
They tried to be a bit clever.
I think they were basically...
They were practicing
for their Think Vitamin podcast they now do.
Yeah.
And so they decided they were going to interview us. Which was interesting, really, to be on the other end of things.
Yeah, it was.
They weren't very interested in interviewing you, as I remember. It was mainly me they wanted to talk to.
I can't remember.
You can't remember it at all.
No.
Trust me, they weren't interested in you.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely positive. So what they did is they interviewed us about running a successful web design agency, which just happens to be my subject when I'm talking at this year's Future of Web Design. There you go for coincidences. Almost like I planned it, except I didn't. Because I'm not that organised. Anyway, this interview is brought to you by Shopify. Shopify is an e-commerce solution made by designers for designers. And for more information on Shopify, visit shopify.com/BoagWorld. So enjoy this wonderful interview of two intellectual giants in the field of web design.
I heard a lot of people say, I'm going off on a tangent.
That was beautifully rolled in beginning of the interview.
Was you mentioning our lovely sponsor, Shopify?
Yeah.
I heard lots of people say good things about Shopify when I was at South by Southwest.
That's because they're good. Only the best. Only the best sponsors for our show. Actually, while I'm at it, thanks go to Andy Wicks for transcribing the show. Much appreciated, Andy. I have to say, you're a very good transcriber. Much better than some of them. But I'm not mentioning names.
No, that wouldn't be a good idea.
That would be rude, wouldn't it?
Right, are you going to stop waffling now?
Well, I did a brilliant intro into this. Anyway, here you go. Here's the interview.
Okay, hi, Paul.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
That's hello, all right. Paul,
and agreeing to let us turn the tables.
Are we not saying hello to Marcus?
Oh, sorry. Hello, Marcus.
Hello.
Hi there. Cool. So,
Kier and Mike.
We're gonna, hi. So, yeah, so we'll ease you guys in gently.
Okay.
Very gently. First of all, to you, Paul. Obviously, now your company is growing big and strong, and you've sort of moved on really from being a web designer or builder.
I know where this is going.
He's going to ask what my job is.
I'm not going to ask that. I'm just going to ask, you know, do you miss doing that? Being hands-on with that sort of thing?
I have moments of it, yeah. Because I'm somebody that has a short attention span and I like skipping from thing to thing, I felt I'd reached a point where I was saying to you before, wasn't I, but when it came to designing, I reached a point where I felt like all my designs were looking the same, which was a kind of indication to me that
I think Marcus is nodding for some reason there, Paul.
So all my designs look the same, yeah. So that to me was the point where I had to start moving on and doing different things. But no, I dabble still. I do Boag World, I do Headscape, but yeah, I do miss it sometimes.
Do you find it on the same subject? Do you find it hard to relinquish that control at all to your?
No, not at all. Sorry, I was answering for Paul.
And I think you're correct. No, I have certain standards that I think we should keep to as a company in terms of quality of code and that kind of thing. But, you know, the guys at Headscape are very good, and so, you know, it's often semantic arguments that we have rather than actually anything of value. In terms of design, I have to battle against the fact that I have personal preferences. I have a design style, as you have a design style. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're working with a designer, you know, they're not everybody in Headscape, not the designers in Headscape, produce design that is in line with my personal aesthetic. And it should be that way, because you want a broad range of stuff. So sometimes I struggle with recognising, yes, this is a good piece of design, it's just not what I like.
Is there not a sort of Headscape aesthetic a little bit?
I think there is to some degree. We pretend there isn't, and we tell our clients there isn't, but I think there probably is, because I think that's largely come about because A, of my own personal bias, but B, because of the type of clients we work with. You know, we could, with the majority of clients we do, we would be laughed out of the room if we did the kind of stuff you do.
That's a bit harsh.
Yeah.
It's
No. I'm not saying.
I hope you're suitably.
No. I'm not saying it's bad. It's good. It's great.
I think a nice big pumping heart on the homepage would go down a tree.
Yeah. You know, you just. I mean, and I know that Mike can do that.
We've been talking Mike up a lot lately.
I know.
So we can start interviewing you now.
Yeah.
Back to the question.
As an inspiration for basically all the guys that work at Headscape to kind of maybe just go down a bit of a different route.
Yeah.
And your work is very inspirational from that point of view. They'll go, oh, yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And they just nice need, you know, they need... you know, they need to have opportunities to break out of the constraints and the boxes that are, you know, they're put in because of the type of clients that we work
so
with.
That raises an interesting question. How do you actually deal with that internally if someone comes and the brief maybe doesn't quite need that kind of new avenues to go down, or how do you hold a designer back from experimenting? Do you give them other outlets internally?
To be honest, our problem is, to be entirely frank with you, the problem we've got at the moment is the other way around.
Okay.
That our designers self-censor themselves because they work on so many of these kinds of sites, and they kind of predict what the client is going to say, and so you hold back sometimes.
And
so,
are they normally right, or is there more room for expression?
Right. They are normally right, but that's not the point.
No, absolutely.
You know, I see it as our job to push the client. I mean, there's a classic example, I won't name the client, but there was one that recently said, yeah, we really want something different and radical, and so, and we said, are you sure? You know, okay, no. So we did all this cool stuff for them, and then they went, oh no, can we check? And I turned around to them at one point and said, you said you wanted radical. Yeah, yeah, we didn't really, did we?
So, yeah, I mean, okay, so still sticking on the subject of web stuff. We talk about it's still design related. You know, I was talking to you the other night about what are quite trendy topics in web design.
Yeah.
And everyone's talking about web typography, for example.
Yeah.
Or the sort of like, let's all close our computers and start drawing pictures all the time.
Who would say a thing like that, Mike? I've said it,
and now I'm going to take it back. Get your computers open again. Scribbling.
Screw scribbling. There's a quote overheard.
But what I was going to ask you is, what do you see as the hot topics, and is there anything in the web world that's going on right now that excites you? And you, Marcus?
No.
Because
I'm much more business oriented. Things that excite me are new
spreadsheets.
No. But we were talking about this when we went and had a sandwich. Because we've been doing it for a long time, the way we keep going is, you know, we set ourselves goals. We've never been kind of like, in 5 years' time, we'll be doing X, Y, and Z. But you kind of talk about stuff, we'd like to be there, and then you think, ooh, we're there. And then you find yourself being a bit kind of like, well, what now then?
Yeah.
And I'm more interested in what the new thing would be. Because I'm not a designer, I'm not a developer, so I don't really feel it's my job to kind of get enthused particularly about any particular HTML5, for example. He's like, great, cool. Paul is much better placed to answer that question, because it's not my specialism. My specialism, if I have one within this world, is talking to people that own websites about what their website could do for them. And so to a certain extent, I do need to be informed, but he does that for me.
So how do you split your work with a new client? Who would be the first? I contact Headscape for whatever reason. We agree to meet. I give you a brief outline of what my requirements are. Would I speak to you? And if so, what kind of stuff would you want to get out from me? And then would you hand over to Paul or the project managers? Or how does it work?
It varies. Usually the initial chat, if it was a really big project, if I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be a big one, then I'll say to somebody on the phone,
give it to someone else.
No, I won't do that. No, rather than just have a lengthy chat on the phone, we'll have a quick chat on the phone, I'll say, I'll come and meet you.
Yeah.
It'll usually just be me at that point. And I, for virtually all projects, people come to us with a, we want to do something, not a kind of, well, we've heard you guys are sort of quite good, what can you do for us? That's because it would be, well, we could have that conversation, but 99% of the time, people have got a pretty specific idea. We want to do X, Y, or Z. So I'll go and talk to them about that and question the why they might want to do that. That's really the big part of it, actually. Is
sure.
So, you know, why do you want to do that? You know, well, how is that going to help you? Is it going to make more money? Or is it going to make your people that come to your site happier?
So very much from the business angle, what the benefits of having a web presence or expanding it will do for their own business.
Yeah.
Bottom line stuff, really.
Yeah, to a certain extent. But also, I mean, that's the kind of nice client that just comes to us. Quite often, what we're doing is responding to invitations to tender. And then it's a case of, again, a brief will come through and we will respond usually with a phone call with questions, you know, what do you mean by this and this and this and this? Are you sure you want to be doing that? And we'll come back with a proposal, and hopefully we'll then get invited to go and talk to these people, at which point I'll wheel him out and he'll enthuse at them for half an hour.
It takes me a while to latch on to the part of the project that excites me. Because if you go into a pitch not excited about the project, you ain't going to win it.
Sure.
But once you've identified that thing in it that really grabs you and you want to do, then I'm away, and it's great. So, I mean, I tend to go in at the pitch stage. I give the big presentation. Then we normally, when we win it, the beginning part of the project is where I flesh out that stuff that I was enthusing about. So where we kind of really develop and set the direction of it. I talk the client through the process, help them to focus the vision. Once that is, and that's done in conjunction with the development team, the project manager and designer and all the rest of it. Once that process has been done, I step back and the project manager runs with the project. But
it's
the
big bit out that I do, but yeah.
Yeah, skip that. Well, there's a whole requirements gathering stage that's tediously boring.
Yeah, requirements, implementing architecture, talking to stakeholder interviews, all that kind of stuff. And then I'll step away from it usually.
Yeah.
Then project manager, designers, developers get on and build it.
So, and then I periodically through the project, I kind of keep an eye on it to make sure that vision that was created at the beginning hasn't been lost at any stage.
Cool. Just quickly, before Mike's got a question, I'm just really intrigued to know, because there's a lot of talk on the web about this, and I hate the term spec work, but Mike and I have talked about this a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm of the opinion that doing a tender, doing a response to a proposal, could be deemed spec work in some respects, because it's, you know, by the definition, you're doing work that you may or may not...
It depends on what the document.
I guess I was kind of get to how much time or, value, what's the end product of that?
The way I define it is, I, as a salesperson, I do information architecture and all that, which is paid work, if you like, but at least 50% of my role is as a salesperson. Salespeople don't get paid by clients.
There is a cost of sale.
They are part of the cost of sale. And if it's work, so therefore, if it's work that I'm doing, then that's fine. If I have to get a designer to do work as part of that document, I don't think that's right.
Because those are chargeable people. It's like I'm a chargeable person. So
we know that, Paul.
The most that Marcus would require from me is to bounce some ideas around in the proposal stage. The pitch, obviously, is free. We would go up and do that. But, I mean, the way I view it, actually, is that... spec work, in my opinion, is work you give to a client that could potentially be used in the actual project. So our proposal documents aren't spec work because they're not... I mean, you disagree.
No, it's not that. It's interesting because you're making it sound a little bit like you go up to a proposal and you do a pitch with nothing.
Correct. Yeah. We do a pitch.
We don't pitch any graphics, ever.
No, never any graphics.
Okay, how much work does, say, goes into a pitch?
Into a pitch? Into the pitch itself?
Not the physical time of the actual pitch.
No, I mean preparing the pitch. Well, the proposal, quite a lot of work goes into that.
At least a day.
Yeah.
No, usually two.
Because that, with the type of work that we do, right... There's quite a lot of boilerplate in it. This is Headscape, this is what we do and stuff. But, you know, these are invitations tended by large public sector organisations, and they want to know finance history, they want to know, you know, the name of your third child, they want to, you know, they really, really go into it. But it's not a document that contains necessarily lots of ideas.
All right.
Right?
But a good way to probably explain the situation. We were just talking about the process we go through when Paul talks to the client. We've won the work, okay? Starts off with him usually analysing their existing website and the brief they've got and talking ideas. Then I'll go and talk to... And he makes a bunch of recommendations out of your own mind, as it were. I'll then test that on a load of stakeholders via one-to-one interviews. We'll then start, based on that, we'll then put together a report which kind of pulls all that together. We'll then do information architecture. Then we'll start doing mood boards that will kick into the actual design.
Because, I mean, our belief...
And that's a load of work that I've just described.
Absolutely.
It's a lot of time that people are paying. If we value giving designs up front, then all of that is pointless.
Because it's purely design. You're making a distinction between someone who's
it's more than just design.
Billable.
Yeah, graphic. No.
Well, that was an easy way of putting it.
It's, no, yeah, I understand.
It's the fact. Right. It's the fact that before the project, before you can make a recommendation to the client, either in terms of visuals or in terms of the direction and vision for the site, you need to understand the client, you need to understand the business and understand the objectives. You never get all of that from a brief. Doesn't matter how thorough they think the brief is, you never get all of that up front. So therefore, you know, what our proposals are kind of vague, a very detailed response to the brief that's been provided, but oftentimes that's not what we end up delivering. We'll win the project, then we'll do a load of research work and turn around to them and say, well, actually, what you asked for out of the gate isn't the right thing. We need to be going in this direction. So the proposal document only exists to establish our credibility and to get us as far as the point of actually winning the work. There's not loads of stuff in that proposal that they could go, aha, okay, I really like this idea and I'm going to take it and go with another agency. You know, it's not that type of document. With a piece of speculative design, they could do that. They could go, aha, I really like this design, I'm going to give it to another designer who's cheaper. So yeah, sure. There is a bit of a difference.
It's more a case of just to finally nail to the table. It's a case, we see proposals and pitches, the proper response from us is to basically tell our prospective clients that we can do a really good job and give them lots of reasons why. And, you know, look, we think your project might be similar to the one we did for this client, and look at all the work we did on this, and this is the process we went through to reach all these things, and with lots of pictures of what we did for that client, but no actual kind of like, but we might be able to do something that looked a bit like this for you, because we think that's
a historical thing though, because you've got a canon of work,
yeah,
you've got
correct.
A heritage. So yeah, what would your advice be to someone who's, you know, when we were chatting earlier, you sort of talking about, you know, the young people coming up through the 18, 19, 20, when you've not got that canon, you've not got that history, how would you advise them to
pitch
for work?
I would encourage them to actually do some voluntary work.
Right. So build up the portfolio, yeah. So you've got that, yeah. That you can then display.
I mean,
yeah. We say that if they're looking for a job.
Yeah.
Well, you know, looking for work, we say, well, you know, that's what we kind of look for. We look for a portfolio. We look for, yeah. What have you done before? So that's what we think clients want as well.
My attitude, right, let's take doing a piece of speculative design work is going to cost 2 days of a designer's time, right? Just plucking random figures out of the air, right? So it's 2 days of a designer's time. Well, you couldn't spend that 2 days doing it for some shifty guy that says, yeah, go on, if you do me a bit of speculative work, you're probably going to win it and it's all going to be great. Because especially when you're starting out, that's the kind of client you're working for, isn't it? Screw that for a game of soldiers. He's just trying to get one over on you. I'd prefer to spend the 2 days working for a local charity that have got no money but a really worthy cause, giving them a great design that they can take away and, you know, build or do what they want with, and then I've got a good portfolio piece. You know, that's kind of my attitude for it.
That said, we used to do designs up front.
Yes, but then we learned that that was it.
We were shooting ourselves in the foot doing
it. I just think, just to, before we move on, I think the one thing that struck me, one of your comments, and I think it was in response to a particular blog post we did.
Right.
Was that you said
the design is
actually bad for the client.
Yeah.
Moreover,
yes,
than the designer. And that's quite a unique perspective, I think. I've not read much.
It's worth reading some of my stuff over that, because I think we have a rock solid argument. And I won't go through the whole argument now because there are other things to talk about. But basically, it boils down to the fact that you are not, as a designer and developer or whatever, you are not well enough informed at the spec stage to produce anything other than a piece of show-off work, right? So all you're doing is going, ta-da! Look how talented we are. You're not solving any problems. You're not challenging their brief. You are literally producing a little bit of fancy work. And the reality is that the client, so if you were the client, you're paying for it anyway. But because we have to roll the cost of sale into the project. But here's the killer. You're not just paying for the piece of speculative work I've done for you, you're also paying for the piece of speculative work that I did for Mike, who then turned us down. because we still have to recover the cost of time we spent doing Mike's piece of work.
Sure.
So the reality is you're paying for your own speculative work and other people's speculative work. Sorry, I'm pointing aggressively.
I'm retracting quickly. But
I'm going to get him a box to stand.
But it's something I get really annoyed about and really passionate about. I would never hire a company that does speculative design work because I'm paying for other people's design work. It doesn't make sense.
Cool, really quickly then.
Sorry.
Moving swiftly on.
Okay, it's fine. Yeah, so just going back to the original question, there's nothing exciting going on in the world.
What's the original question?
Yeah, I was very conscious we went off on the tangent of that. Yes,
so is there anything exciting
there is
going on?
I'm a great... There are two levels of excitement, right? There's the Silicon Valley web app trendy stuff that everybody features type of excitement, right? The cutting edge, you know, we're some fancy agency, you know, fancy, you know, startup with loads of venture capital, right? And a lot of times you do, when you go to a conference or whatever, there are all these big names from these doing amazing things. Yes, we're dealing with scalability on the millions of hits and, you know, and we're dealing with this really... And you think, no, yes, very interesting, but no kind of impact on my life, right? But over time, that cool stuff begins to trickle down. And that is, I get excited at the next tier down. I get excited when I start to see all of that cool stuff that maybe is old hat now, right? That everybody was talking about a year ago or 2 years ago. When I start seeing that appearing on average websites, websites that the vast majority of us are working on.
Can you give us an example of something that's done that for you recently?
Just this whole web application culture of, you know, JavaScript driven application, like desktop, like for such a long time that was only for things like, I don't know, Twitter and, well, not Twitter, but Gmail and and Google Maps and stuff like that. But now that's all trickling down and you're starting to see rich internet applications in boring everyday sites, you know, whether it be a university site or Sussex Police. I mean, Anna was telling me about a police website where if you hear a police helicopter flying over you, right, at night, you can look up the next day to see why it was there and what it was doing and whether the issue be, so the, you know, and all of those kind of web 2.0 things about openness and transparency and as well as the technology stuff like Ajax, all of that now is becoming mainstream. And I get excited about where fringe stuff becomes mainstream and all the bigger community of developers outside of the valley are doing that kind of stuff. Yeah. So that's why I'm excited about the web. I'm excited about stuff everybody else was excited about a year, 2 years ago.
Cool. So do you want
to... Yeah, so... We wanted to move on to the subject of blogging.
Yeah.
As a company, I believe I'm right in saying you don't blog.
Not as a company, no.
You blog as Berg World, but more recently, we've both been intrigued to why he's kind of doing more personal stuff on...
Yeah.
Is it Posterous, how you say it?
Posterous, yeah.
Posterous.
Or Posterous.
So, Posterous, yeah. Even better. So I guess, really, we're trying to work out, is Berg World purely for, you know, the educational side? Is your... And you know, some of your articles on your microblog are personal.
Yeah.
You know, we were particularly struck by the what was the title of it? Something Stinks.
Oh,
personal branding stinks. So using video, using that.
Yeah.
Use audio boo. So you've got a lot of outlets. How do you decide what goes where? How is it off the cuff?
The problem,
how is it planned?
You're making a fundamental mistake here.
I make many, Paul.
The fundamental mistake you're making is you're presuming that I have a strategy. Which
no,
I'm
not.
Really, really
well, no,
don't.
The thing is, no, what, you've missed no that, strategy is fine.
Well, you missed that a little bit, Keir.
I missed that. I can't read the writing.
No, but I think it's... there's a tiny... The question was, actually, in favour, is that what do you get out of blogging, both professionally and personally?
Right.
Well, I kind of...
No, you did say that, but I'm just saying it. I'm just saying it. No, but no, only because... No, you didn't say it wrong.
No,
you didn't say it wrong.
This is a good interview. I've never been so professional.
Just on top of what Keir said, everything he said plus, just the fact that...
Apparently Anna can cut stuff out.
It's obvious that you get something out of blogging.
Yeah,
and it isn't just it isn't just about I mean, it might help you gain work for SEO, I don't know, but but it's obviously more than that, and I think that'd be interesting to know.
Okay, let's there's quite a mess there that I've got to work through. Let me see if I can find a question in there somewhere.
Ooh.
Yeah,
we don't do this for a living, you know.
No. Right, there's a few things to comment on. First of all, without a doubt, blogging is a major marketing tool for Headscape. The vast majority of our new business comes in via that, so it's definitely and categorically a business tool. But it didn't start out that way, right? When I started out blogging, it came out a little bit of ego. I wanted, you know, we went to AppMedia 2005 and they actually got different bloggers to stand up. I thought, I want to be like that, you know, and so I got very inspired and I started blogging partly that. But I quickly discovered nobody was interested in what I was writing at the time. So it became, the blog for me became this place where I could take what I'm learning and picking up and rewrite it and rationalise it in a way that made sense to me. So it was a way of me wrapping my head around everything that was going on. It was also a way of me storing and holding the stuff I was learning, because my memory is horrendous. And I, to this day, I go, I'm sure I've written something about that. And I can search on my own blog, and then I can remember. I know this sounds stupid, but I really do this. And then I'll read through my blog and go, okay, so that's what I'm supposed to think about this. But it really helps to clarify my thinking. So that was a big part of it. The domain was bought, you know, I was thinking I'd write a bit about web design, a bit about whatever I was into. It's my personal website. And as I wrote more, I was writing about web design because that was really what I was into at the time, and my head was buzzing with all this stuff. This was in the period with web standards, and we were getting into accessibility, and then other people started taking an interest in it, and grew. And then I started the podcast, which was really came out of the fact that I got an iPod for Christmas that was just beginning to start support podcasts, and I looked for a web design one and there wasn't one, so I thought, well, I'll do that because that's easier than writing stuff because I'm crap at writing.
Hello, this is Paul. This is the first ever Boeing.
Which is pretty much what it sounds like. It's like stepping back in time listening to those old ones.
How long ago was that, Paul?
2005?
Maybe, I don't know.
2005, 2006, I'd have to look. So, it must have been 2005. So it was growing and it was building momentum, and eventually it basically became this thing of its own, really. It was, you know, it was beginning to have marketing benefits. I was starting to spend some of my work time doing this. So relatively recently, I came to this realization that Headscape had robbed me of my blog, right? Which I'm quite happy with, because it turns into this great marketing tool and it's fun to do and I love to do it. But I had nowhere to share, I don't know, a silly video of James or some cool thing that was nothing to do with web design or whatever else. So that's where Posterous came from. It was just an easy way for me to talk about stuff that's not about web design. Occasionally, bits of web design stick in. I'll tell you my dirty little secret over this one, which is that often, if there's an idea I've had, I'm too lazy to write a blog post about it. So if it's to do with web design, too lazy to write a blog post, too busy, I'll record a video. But I don't put the video onto Boag World because there's an expectation that I get a transcript of it, and it has to be to make it accessible. So instead I just put it on Posterous to get around it, which is really naughty and I should be ashamed of myself, but I do occasionally do that. But most of the time Posterous is just about me having fun. Then you get into things like Audio Boo. Audio Boo is just, again, was this idea in my view is about micro podcasting, like Twitter is micro blogging. So again, it's little snippets of tips and advice. So how do I decide what goes on where, right?
You're interviewing yourself now.
Yeah. I'm trying to work through the questions.
I'm just going to get some coffee. Marcus?
So basically, if it's not good enough and not long enough to be a blog post, it'll become an audio boo, right? If it's about web design. If it's about web design and it's too long for an audio boo, it's a blog post. If it's not about web design, it's Posterous.
Right. So you do have a strategy.
But where it falls down is often I'll do a little audio boo about something, which is the beginning of a thought. Mm. then it turns into a blog post, and then it ends up on the podcast as well. So it kind of ripples through.
Okay, that's cool, but
but I didn't answer your
question. No, you didn't answer the question. It's interesting to know that, definitely. But what I personally like to know is what is it that makes you interested in sharing, especially actually the web stuff you've clarified. It's obviously of great benefit to the business, but. What is it that makes you want to share such personal stuff sometimes? And, you know, I know you're a Christian and you talk about God, but you also talk about some other personal stuff too. And it's, you know, you just obviously sit down and make a little video and share everyone. And what is it that makes you want to do that? Because obviously not everyone feels like that.
I think it's two things. It's two major parts of my personality. One is that I am a massive extrovert, so I'm a massive show-off. I'm never happier than when I've got an audience, right? To be entirely frank. Yeah.
Did anyone spotted that? No.
And like Marcus says, I can't sing or play a musical instrument, so the best
and like
I can
Marcus
do is
should act.
Jump up and down, wave my arms in the air and say, please look at me. So there's that aspect to it. I think there's also another aspect. Somebody said to me, right when I was a young kid, turned to me and said, Paul, the thing about you is you live with your heart on your sleeve. What you see is what you get. And I still think I'm like that now. So I'm just amazing. I'm a very open person. You know, if I'm grumpy, everybody knows I'm grumpy. If I'm happy, everybody knows I'm happy. And I live my life in the open and always have. I do that online because I'm not a different person online than I am offline. And I know a lot of people are and they choose to be that. But I'm not.
Yeah, cool. Okay, that's a nice explanation.
So, I mean, one of the questions you had was about honesty in speaking and blogging. I mean, do you ever...
No, I make up stuff all the time.
But, I mean, it's very hard to be honest, and you know, in all spheres of life, isn't it? You know, but do you feel you're probably as honest as you are?
Does this go back to the conversation we were having previously, Mike?
It does go back to the conversation we were having previously, yeah.
Because we had this conversation between me and Mike about... When you stand on the stage, and sometimes you get off after doing a presentation and go, why did I say that? I said that because I think that's what people expected me to say rather than what it was actually doing. I mean, you gave the example about, you know, you gave a talk where you talked about sketching and that, you know, always get away from your computer and sketch. That's not what he actually does.
Yeah. I admitted that. Yeah, it was between you, mate.
Yeah. I've never said that. Well, it was either that or share an example of when I did that, and I'd prefer to humiliate you rather than me.
It's true, no, I want to reverse that.
Yeah, well, you said that.
Anna can apparently cut this out. So no, all right.
No, we tell people that, but it's a lie. And I've done similar things. I'll be honest. For me, where the line comes with honesty is, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying I think this is the way it should be. Right?
That's what you said, yeah.
But where you fall down and it gets a bit shady is where you say, I think this is the way it should be, but fail to then mention that, well, actually, we aren't there yet, but we're kind of heading in that direction. I've made that mistake too. But I do try and be transparently honest. I don't try and dress up anything that I talk about. And in fact, I'm probably a bit self-deprecating, actually. I think a lot of people think that I'm a bit of a joker and a bit of a moron. But I do like to simplify things. I do like to take the mystery out of stuff. And I think there are a lot of people... again, this goes back to our conversation. It's a lot of people making it sound like their job is a lot fancier and harder and more difficult than really it is. And we do like to kind of justify our own existence by using lots of clever words and having processes and methodologies and systems.
I agree. Cool. No, thanks. So, something else me and Kira have been talking about lately, just, again, it's sort of got related to blogging and just actually the whole web, you know, where you put one's position in the web industry, and that's, you know, status, you know, Twitter followers, everything. You know, how important do you think status is in the industry?
Okay, I'm glad you worded that question the way you did, because I was worried you were going to word it. How important is status to you? and that you'd purposely put the question about honesty beforehand.
Well, no, actually, I've got a bit here, it's screwed out, and it said, how big is your ego?
Yeah. And I said, no, we can't ask him that.
It also comes off the back of what we were talking about before. It also comes off the back of your video about the personal branding.
Yeah.
This question actually isn't about personal branding, but it is about...
I didn't believe a word of that, by
how important do you think it is? Yeah. How important do you think it is? I mean, because obviously...
I guess it's also talking about web celebrity. I mean, this is kind of, I mean, this whole
celebrity.
You know,
I
like that.
Right up my nose.
But you know, a lot of people would refer to you as one of the proud pulls. So
it's really difficult. You couldn't.
To that.
You are definitely a web celebrity.
He's pointing again.
Entirely.
Just start punching us.
I know. I'm quite scared.
I'm going to be entirely honest about it, right? Which I don't think a lot of people are. Yes, I love it. Of course I do. Of course you love it when someone comes up to you and says, hey, Paul, you know, you're Paul Barrag, aren't you? You know, and I really love what you do. And anybody that pretends that they don't like being praised is a liar.
I've got quite a funny story, actually. I went to the Comedy Store in Leicester Square last Friday evening. And we got a beer and, you know, and sat in our seats and everything. And this young couple...
Right.
You know, must have been early 20s, both of them. Come and sit down next to us. This is for the first half. And I kept seeing this guy looking at me. I thought, he's recognised me.
You went out and said, you know him.
Nothing was said. And an interval comes. Get another beer, sit back down. And he said, I think I know who you are.
Right.
And I was like,
you got it wrong.
You Paul Boak.
No, what? If what Paul, I'm just supporting what Paul's saying. I get recognised at conferences. People go and say something. That's what they would say to me. especially the Americans.
Brilliant.
So I'm like saying, so I turned to the guy and said, so you're a web designer? They said, no, I think my mum's got one of your records.
Well, that's not what you're talking about.
Brilliant.
But it's gone around the other way now that somebody young, I expect to recognise me from the podcast.
Was it your daughter's friend came up and knew you from the podcast or something?
Yeah. I mean, it still amazes me because I just kind of pitch up once a week and just try and, you know, make him look stupid.
I always forget what band was it you were in again?
A band called Breathe.
Now in Stroke the Toad.
Yes, Stroke the
Toad. I think to say that you don't like that, I mean, I was at Thorpe Park recently with my youth group, and we were queuing up. Some guy came up to me and said, you Paul Barrag. I mean, my youth group were wetting themselves. They thought it was hilarious. And I'd like it. Of course I do. You know, it's really, people are really kind and they're really nice over it. But you've got to keep it in perspective, right? You know, I'm a niche of a niche of a niche of a niche. Yeah. You know, I might aspire to be Leo Laporte, right? Leo Laporte might aspire to be a daytime TV presenter who aspires to be, a kind of a mainstream TV presenter who aspires to be a film thing, and so it goes on. And I think it's the whole premise that I reject the premise, which is this premise that because you're well known and because a lot of people have heard of you, that in some way your life is of more value. And that was the point that I was trying to get across in the personal branding thing. That I've got, there's a friend of mine that I grew up with who got married to an Indian guy. And she works out in India. We actually raise money for her on the podcast at Christmas, and runs an orphanage out there with kids, you know, with a couple of hundred kids who have had their lives ruined. She does more good in a single day than I will do in my lifetime. And okay, nobody knows about her. Nobody is interested in her. And I get people come up to me on the tube, you know. That's ridiculous to me, and that's what made me angry and made me want to do that post. And then it all gets out of proportion, it all gets silly. Where in our culture, sorry, this is getting really heavy, where in our culture did we get to a point where Kevin Rose can't stand in a blooming party, you know, without being mobbed by people? That's weird. that's weird. There's something screwed up with
it. The thing is, it's not weird at all. I think it's just normal, isn't it?
I know it's been going.
It's not weird, though. It's
natural
normal.
To be.
No, I don't.
I guess celebrity's changing, whereas when I was growing up, it was the pop stars, the rock stars, and now you've got tech celebrities, and for someone. Rock stars of a similar age, if you had a rock star
in their room, they would be even more mobbed.
Yes, I know.
But it still happens.
But, okay. Just because it's normal doesn't make it not weird. Just because it's been going for hundreds of years doesn't make
it
weird.
Well, I'd say it's human nature.
Yeah, and I'm saying human nature sucks.
Well, deal with it.
I'm an idea.
Okay, so getting down to, you know how you feel about it, but do you actually, obviously it has some sort of benefits for you, but do you think it's important to have...
I think, in the industry?
Yeah.
It is.
Of course it is. When I was just thinking about this, you know, it's probably... I was going to say, who's the most famous web celeb? Zelben, maybe?
Yeah, you know,
people with really decent web projects... with good budgets and are going to do good work, go to Happy Cog because of Zeldman's celebrity.
And the sad
not
fact...
Not only that, but, you know, he wouldn't be famous if he hadn't, you know, didn't know his stuff and he talked well, etc, etc.
And the sad fact is there are designers and developers and agencies out there that are as good as Happy Cog.
Of course there are.
And there's certainly ones that are better than us. You know, but they don't get the exposure because they're... introverted people, and it makes me sad, but that's the reality.
The only thing also is you actually said the other day on your
video, don't quote back stuff that I've said, I often contradict myself.
You said maybe it wasn't that one, it was another one, but you said that actually you didn't need, you could be introverted and still be just as successful as
I think you can in a different way. I think you need to recognise...
One successful way.
Well, you can be as good a designer, definitely. You can be as good a developer, you don't have to be famous, but I guess if you're trying to win business using the Zeldman Happy Cog argument, then you're going to be a lot better off if you're somebody who's known.
But you could still be known and an introvert. It's identifying the methods by which you're known. Right. So, for example, Rachel Andrews.
Drew's husband.
Now I'm immediately going to be in trouble with her again. I was really concentrating on whether it was the S or not the S. Anyway, until relatively recently, she didn't do a huge amount of public speaking, and even now doesn't do massive amounts. But she has written book after book after book after book, and she's known for that writing, and that has given her the profile.
Yeah.
You know, you could be an introvert and blog and have one of the best blogs in the world. You could have, you know, you could be submitting gorgeous designs to CSS galleries and win work that way. So it doesn't need to be just by being mouthy and extrovert.
I think you're totally right there. I mean, the thing is... The funny thing is, like you said, there's agencies out there who are as good as each other. Some might win work because of their public persona, and they're out there and everyone knows about them. But there are definitely people out there who are well known because they repeatedly put out excellent, high standard work.
Yeah. And there are others that might win work because they've got a really pushy salesman.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just another way of marketing yourself or your company.
To be honest, look at yourself, Mike, right? Okay, you've done a couple of speaking slots, but you haven't spoken a huge amount.
No, I'm not.
Your work has got picked up by people, and people have gone, wow, I really like that. And that's spread virally without necessarily you jumping up and down like I do, going, look at me, you know?
Yeah.
So it's perfectly possible.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a different way of doing it.
Yeah. You have add, Kieran?
No, not on that. I mean, I think the only other question we haven't written this down, but I think it's, again, something we've all talked about, and I believe you're talking to Mike about it. A lot of people are well-known for their niches. Like you've, in the last few years, have talked a lot about educating clients, dealing with clients, and that's becoming your kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mike's talked a lot about inspiration and how he gets ideas, which tend to be offline.
Yeah.
Yeah. Andy Clark talks a lot about progressive CSS, CSS3, that kind of thing. Is that something for someone maybe who wants to get into the industry, something that they should maybe find something that really fascinates them and push it out?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. I remember much, much nearer the beginning, I'd built up a popular podcast that a lot of people listen to and were passionate about, but I couldn't get speaking opportunities. And I think it was Ryan, actually, that was honest enough to talk to me properly about it. And his response was, I don't know what you do. I don't know what you heard. I mean, a lot of people don't know what I do, but you know,
that's a whole other interview.
Yeah, yeah. But he didn't know what box to put me in. He didn't know people like putting other people in boxes.
Well, it makes picking speakers easy.
Yes,
to be honest.
Yeah.
We know
so
that.
You can go, okay, we need someone in this slot that's going to talk about business or is going to talk about development or whatever else. And once I decided what that, you know, what I packaged myself very specifically for conferences, certainly in speaking slots, look, this is what I'm the guy, I will talk about this kind of stuff. And once you've done it once, that's it, boom, you know, and then if, you know, it then went. But the problem is you can't do that forever. You need to reinvent yourself. And Mr. Keith has been extremely good. Jeremy Keith is very good at that. You know, he started off DOM scripting guy. Then he became the micro formats guy. Now he's the HTML5 guy. You know, he knows how to move from thing to thing. Now, he would say that it's because his interests change and he moves on. It might be. It might be a completely subconscious thing, but it's a damn clever thing, you know, however you slice it.
I would argue that this applies to life, not just web design. I've got quite big kids now, and I've been saying to them for years, relating this to the subjects that they're studying. I've got one that's gone on to college now, and I've always said to them, do what you like doing, don't do what you think you ought to be doing. And I think that applies across the board. If you can do something well, then you've got to enjoy doing it.
Yeah, and that'll come out when you speak about it. It'll come out the passion.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool, yeah, that's about it.
Thank you.
We've got a whole podcast here.
I'm sorry.
45 minutes.
Yeah. But there we go.
Really?
We're releasing our special. Cool. Okay, well, thank you very much
for
listening to Boag World. We'll see you again next week.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot.
So we come to our listener contribution section of the show, and we have a great thought for the day, really, which is a very Radio 4 thing. Or is it Radio 1? Radio 2.
4.
Radio 2.
I don't even know if Radio 4 still do Thought for the Day. They probably do.
I think they do. But now you have, you know, atheists on it.
Goodness. What's the world coming to?
I know. It's disgraceful. Actually, there was a campaign recently.
There was.
Over that exact issue. We won't go into that subject. Anyway, this little thought for the day, which you will hear in a moment, is brought to you by Rosenfeld Media. Rosenfeld Media publish short, practical and useful books and webinars on user experience design. Their products exist to help web and other design professionals make informed design decisions. If you want to check out the books and webinars that they're running, you can do so at rosenfeldmedia.com. That's rosenfeldmedia.com. Okay, so what I will do now is we will hand over to Phil Powell, who will introduce this interesting topic to us.
Let me get this out of the way at the start. I'm a disabled web user, registered as severely sight impaired. I'm also a web designer and developer, have been for over 10 years. I'm not just a tinkerer, I've worked for the likes of Audi, Levi's, Adidas, and even won a few awards for my work with U2. In the early days, like many of us, I didn't take issues of accessibility as seriously as I ought to have done. I committed my fair share of usability sins and implemented some really bad design decisions. But I saw the error of my ways, and nowadays I'm a loud advocate for good standards and better accessibility. And as both a disabled web user and a web practitioner, I think I have some useful insights to offer on how we might make the web a more accessible place, not just for those who are disabled, but for everybody. There have been fantastic advances in improving access to the web over the past 10 years or so. The wider adoption of web standards by both browser vendors and web practitioners has brought huge benefits to all types of disabled users. These advances have helped to inform trends in web design and development in a myriad of positive ways. Personally, I'm finding that my web experience is steadily improving thanks to these adoptions, which is a fantastic thing. There is still some way for us to go, though. I still occasionally stumble across high-traffic sites which are terribly inaccessible. Code soup which makes a site unintelligible to screen readers. Design treatments which bewilder anybody with learning difficulties. Tiny hit areas which make for horrible target practice amongst those with motor disabilities. These aren't old creaking relics of a bygone cyber era either. They are new, high-profile commissions. Sure, not everybody is signed up to web standards, nor is every web designer or developer experienced enough to appreciate the importance of accessibility. But from my experience, it seems that public sector and cultural organisations are the ones who are failing the most. This always baffles me a little, as you'd expect publicly focused bodies to have a commitment, and in many cases be required, to ensure accessibility to all. Ignoring disabled members of society in the physical world is wholly unacceptable, so why do we still tolerate it in our virtual world? Well, part of the reason, I think, is due to a slightly skewed way we think about disability. It's often quite easy to fall into the trap of thinking of someone with a disability as part of a generalised group. Someone who is blind, who is deaf, who is a wheelchair user. The fact is that not every disability is the same, and the acuteness and intricacies of a disability can affect people in so many varying ways. This misconception makes it a complex and confusing subject to understand, especially for people with deadlines. But I think there's something else we need to address. Our industry isn't innovating enough. We're simply not being intelligent enough with our design of the web. Now, that reads as quite a bold assertion, so I'll try to explain where I'm coming from. I'm a firm believer that good design should be both beautiful in its aesthetics and in the way it functions. But it seems that a lot of the time when it comes to designing for the web, aesthetics and functionality are treated as two very separate disciplines. I'm generalising, but I'll bet that the approach to the design of most web projects is still either a great visual style which needs to function well, or a functional architecture which needs to look good. One generally informs the other. I'd like to see the wider adoption of a new, emerging type of web design, where style and function are embraced as a single integrated discipline. Gone are the days when a designer's job stops when they hand over a Photoshop mock-up to a site builder. And similarly, gone are the days when site builders try to design in the browser and then a visual style is conjured up around markup. Both of these approaches have their benefits, but equally, both have their failings. Can we not be a bit more inventive? I think this is where accessibility could step in. I think accessibility can be a killer tool for some amazing design, but it needs us to look at it in a new way. As much as any of us claims to take it seriously, how often do we think about how it can be done better? The tendency is to just tick the boxes and then move on to another pressing task. Rather than being a secondary consideration in the design and build of our web experiences, we can better use the disciplines of accessibility and usability as tools to inform and inspire beautiful aesthetics and functional design. Good accessibility doesn't just have to be something which assists people with a disability. We need to flip that idea on its head. Accessibility should be embraced as a way to allow us all to adapt our online experiences to fit the way we use the web. Disability or no disability. Better access to the places we visit on the web doesn't just benefit people who are disabled, it benefits everyone. Apple are a rare example of a company who take good design seriously and who are already doing amazing things in this field, albeit with installed software. I have very low vision due to a rare form of albinism. My distant sight is really bad. I wouldn't be able to recognise your face across a room, but my near vision is exceptionally good. I excel when working with pixels and details. I predominantly do most of my work on OS X because it has so many low-level accessibility aids built right in. I can zoom the screen with keyboard shortcuts. Well-adopted UI guidelines make it easy for me to understand a new app. Standard controls and focus help me to navigate without a mouse. Finding files, running applications, and searching can all be done swiftly and easily using the keyboard. I adopted an iPhone for the very same reasons. Not because I'm an Apple fanboy, but because it brings with it the same accessible features as my operating system. Features I've struggled to find in any other mobile device. For me, these are amazing productivity tools. I tend to work faster and with more efficiency than my well-sighted peers, and that's pretty much down to my use of accessible tools. I've adapted my working world to not only achieve an equal footing, but my adaption allows me to be more productive than many able people. But these enhancements haven't been developed for the sole use of people with a disability. They are elements of good, well-considered design, beautiful in both aesthetics and function, which are available to all. You can try it right now. If you're using a fairly modern version of Safari, hit Command F, then start typing a word, and you'll see a perfect example of what I mean. If you're using another browser, chances are you're missing out on the advantages of a piece of simple but clever assistive design. Assistive accessibility means providing add-on tools which help people. My local co-op print braille labels on their wine bottles, a nice bit of assistive design which helps us visually impaired lot choose our tipple. A worthy amount of effort goes into the transcription of subtitles and closed captions for TV programs and DVDs, a service many of us don't use but which is an invaluable assistive tool for the hard of hearing. And incidentally, a tool which is only now appearing as a feature in mainstream online video services. Adaptive accessibility is about building things into our everyday world, which aren't used by everybody all of the time, but are available as a helper to everybody all of the time. It can be something as simple as a handrail on a stairwell. The more sprightly among us may bound upstairs two at a time. Those who are more elderly need the extra support. Sometimes children use it. If you're tired, lazy, carrying something heavy, you might use it. You adapt your behaviour through the use of the tools around you, depending on all sorts of factors. I see no reason why this analogy can't be translated into our experience of our online world. We're moving away from the desktop to devices in our pockets, on our laps, in our cars. We can go online virtually anywhere, with different distractions, different demands for our attention. We're moving away from navigating with a keyboard and mouse to using touch, gesture, using our voices, using our ears. Now this might come as a surprise to you, but us disabled lot are way ahead of the game when it comes to alternative ways to navigate the online world. So, how do we start building more adaptive online experiences? I do not have a simple answer as to how we achieve this. I'm merely posing the question and acting as an advocate for the discussion of ideas. Perhaps it involves rationalising the UI design of the web. The adoption of iPhone design conventions shows an early example of what this might mean. Perhaps it means decoupling data and presentation even more than we already have, and looking at a more ubiquitous approach to design. Perhaps it means we'll see the emergence of new creative workflows and a new breed of designer. There are plenty of creative technologists emerging who fit the mould. Perhaps we'll invent new tools, services and devices which change the way we experience and perceive the web. Or perhaps we'll just keep plodding on for the next 10 years, pontificating and prevaricating, waiting year on year for the ratification of standards, stifling our creativity, innovating by increments, never really being progressive, never being bold. History has taught us that freedom and inclusion can reap huge rewards for all members of our society. The World Wide Web has shown us an inkling of its potential. But unless we take a good, hard look at one of its core principles, access for all, then that potential may not have a chance to blossom.
Thank you very much, for Phil. That was brilliant. Marcus, you were going to argue with all of it, weren't you?
I thought
it was brilliant, personally, and I don't think you should dare criticise it.
It was excellent.
I just had one small point, one small thing which I've lost again.
You just spent half an hour trying to find it.
Keep talking, Paul. It was to do with the two aesthetics and functionality being treated as two very separate disciplines.
Yes.
He said, I'm generalising, but I'll bet that the approach to the design of most web projects is still either a great visual style which needs to function well or a functional architecture. And he'd like to see a wider adoption of a new emerging type of design where style and function are embraced as a single integrated discipline. This was the bit. Gone are the days where a designer's job stops when they hand over a Photoshop mock-up to a site builder. Now, yes, that has gone, but there is still, it seems that there is a kind of move towards specialisms where designers design, coders code. You know.
Yeah.
So,
yes, I think there is that. You could look at, say, a company like ClearLeft, which do divide up like that. But I think that they would hotly dispute the fact that when the designer hands over the Photoshop document, that's it. I'm sure the designer has lots more involvement in how it's built and checking it visually works and all the rest of it. I think it's specialists working in a group.
Yeah, that works, but
I'm sure that's what Phil meant, and you're misinterpreting him.
Okay, fine.
Okay, thank you very much.
I can't really remember.
It was a good section by Phil, and I really appreciate you taking the time to do it. If you have got ideas of stuff that you want to write about, we would love to hear from you. Please drop me an email at paul@boagworld.com. We're always interested to hear other people's perspective. Okay, so do you have a joke to finish us with?
No.
Pardon me?
No.
Just no. You're not even going to apologise in any way or going to explain why you've become so slack. What if I just said, oh no, I haven't got a feature for today? Would that be acceptable? People have come to expect the joke from you.
I know. But there's no point in handing them out anything that's not up to quality.
There you go, you've done your joke. Great. The hypocrisy of it all.
I have to have things that make me go hee hee that I'm allowed to say on air, so
right.
to speak.
So again, you need to send jokes to Marcus at boagworld.com.
Yes, please send me jokes, marcus@boagworld.com. Want more jokes.
More jokes. On their websites full of thousands of jokes you could just go to and look up yourself, you lazy ass.
That just seems wrong.
Does it?
And I don't know why.
Yeah. No, it's not.
But it seems wrong.
Okay. Doing this podcast seems wrong, but I've been doing it for enough years.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much for listening to this week's show. A little bit more giggly and childish than normal, if such a thing is possible. But hopefully you find it useful. I mean, it was really great to have that new perspective on accessibility that I found very encouraging. And also, it was really interesting to have the tables turned on us for a change and hear about how we ran a web design agency. Hopefully that's all useful stuff to you, and we will talk to you again next week. The podcast for those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. Contract code 020 815
03-5122 or join our forum at bikeworld.com/forum.